For the last 10 days, I have been obsessed with watching and following the trial of Jennifer Crumbley. Jennifer Crumbley is the mother of the Oxford High School shooter. You may recall that on November 30th, 2021, a mass shooting occurred at Oxford High School in the Detroit suburb of Oxford Township. The shooter was charged with more than 24 counts, and he eventually pled guilty, and he was sentenced to life in prison without the possibility of parole. In a first-of-its-kind event, the Oakland County prosecutor opted to charge the shooter's parents with four counts of involuntary manslaughter, one count for each of the four fatalities that occurred at the hands of the shooter. Now, I'm not going to recap the events of November 30th, but I will remind you that four children died that day: Hannah St. Juliana, Tate Meir, Justin Schilling, and Madison Baldwin. They were shot by Jennifer Crumbley's son, using a gun that was purchased for the shooter by Jennifer Crumbley's husband, James Crumbley. He is the father of the shooter. The trial of Jennifer Crumbley involved many witnesses, including school employees, representatives of law enforcement, Jennifer Crumbley's boss and coworkers, as well as the office manager of the gun shop where James Crumbley went with his son, the shooter, to buy the 9mm handgun used at Oxford High School on November 30th. After a day and a half of deliberating, the jury found Jennifer Crumbley guilty on all four counts of involuntary manslaughter. Her husband, James, has his own trial set for March of 2024. I, and I'm sure many of you, have questions about Jennifer's trial. There was a group of us following proceedings each day online in the Michigan True Crime Discussion Group on Facebook. I pulled several questions from the group and brought them here so I could ask my friend, criminal defense attorney Bob Mata, who is also host of the Defense Diaries podcast, if he could clear things up for us. What you're going to hear next is a discussion of some of the issues surrounding the trial, as well as Bob's opinion as a criminal defense attorney of the way things were handled during the trial. This is not meant to be an in-depth look at the trial. It's more a follow-up to what we saw over the last 10 days. So thank you for agreeing to talk with me about this case.
Of course. It's an important case.
I don't think a lot of people realize that this is the first time that prosecutors have gone after the parents of a school shooter for their role in the school shooting.
Yeah, it's, I was trying to, you know, on my Twitter and my YouTube channel, I was really trying to explain to people that this particular case is going to change the fabric of society in terms of how law enforcement and prosecutors' offices across the country are going to deal with parents in these particular types of situations. And frankly, it can expand beyond just school shootings. I mean, this verdict, in my estimation, has put parents on notice that you better keep a better eye on your kids, you
yes.
know, because otherwise, at the end of the day, you could be held responsible for their criminal actions that happen outside of your presence as parents. So it's a huge verdict.
Now, one of the things that I've seen brought up is that all the parents of all the school shooters should be worried. Do you agree with that? Like going back retroactively?
I think it's a distinct possibility. Because the interesting thing about this is, as you said, this is the first time that a parent has ever been held criminally liable under a homicide statute. So it was involuntary manslaughter, but if you look at the Michigan statutes, that falls under the homicide statute. It's just a different form of homicide. You have, you know, your first degree, your second degree, and then your involuntary manslaughter. It's the first time it's ever been done. And what that means, as far as I know, and I know it's the case in Illinois, there is no statute of limitations in terms of whether or not a state has blown a statute in order to be able to go after the parents criminally, meaning that they would be barred because the statute has run. There is no statute of limitations on homicide, meaning
correct.
They could charge somebody from 70 years ago. So I think if I were the parents of past school shooters, especially in cases where the shooter has committed suicide at the end of the, you know, kind of the end of the event.
Yeah.
And there was no justice served on anybody. In those cases in particular, I would be extremely concerned if I were those parents, because all it takes is subpoenas and warrants for phone records to see what the parents knew, to see if they were aware, you know, because this became a knowledge thing. You know, this was a thing that ultimately the state was able to prove that they knew, or they should have known, them being James and Jennifer, that he was in mental distress and that it was foreseeable based on that distress that he was going to do what he was going to do.
For those who are listening that didn't get to watch the entire trial, you brought up text messages, and they brought in a ton of text messages, like pages and pages and pages of text messages, Facebook messages. They subpoenaed Facebook and had deleted messages reactivated so that they could be read. The prosecution was extremely thorough in building their case piece by piece using Jennifer and James Crumbley's own words.
Yep. And they had to be, because in this case where Jennifer Crumbley wasn't the actor, meaning that she wasn't the one that was pulling the trigger, in order to attach the criminal liability, they had to show foreseeability. And in order to show foreseeability, they had to prove that they had knowledge, or that they should have known. And what they did initially, you know, some of the most damning, for me personally, some of the most damning evidence that was introduced was the text streams between Ethan and Jennifer from March of the same year of the shootings, several months prior, where Ethan is texting his mother. She was at the stables, you know, because she was had a horse hobby that took up a lot of her time. But I wasn't sweating the parents on having hobbies. You know,
no.
We all have hobbies. We all, you know, are probably on our devices too much. We all probably should spend a little more time with our kids. I think that could be said about all parents. This went beyond that, because what they showed is this text thread between Ethan and his mother on this particular night where she was gone, and he's saying, oh, you know, there's a demon in the house. And, you know, the demon's throwing bowls in the kitchen, and, you know, I don't know what to do, and I'm freaking out, and, you know, can you text me back? And so the defense tried to handle that in a way where they basically said, look, you know, when we bought this house, which was built in 1920 or 1930, I can't remember which, you know, we've always thought it was haunted, especially Ethan. Ethan always thought that the house was haunted. He used to go in the basement with his Ouija board with his one friend.
Yep.
You know, and he would make videos talking about here's supernatural activity going on. You know, so we always just thought it was just him being him, that he was just being goofy and he was talking about that, which is fine. Like that alone is fine. But when they get into the day of the shooting and they produce his math quiz or math test with the writing and the drawings,
the bloody body, the gun,
all of it, you know, and the writing is even more shocking. And as a parent, I had a very, very firm position on how I would have responded if I was handed a piece of paper that my child had written that day that said, the thoughts won't stop. Help me in
help
bold.
Me.
Help me.
Well, and
bold.
we both have teenagers. So
yeah.
I think my daughter is a month older than the shooter, like almost exactly.
Yeah.
So I think as both of us being parents, seeing our child exhibiting something like that, writing something like that, alarm bells start going off. But they didn't for the Crumbleys.
Nina, if I'm handed that piece of paper in the school, and the way that it went down is Jennifer was emailed it, the document first. So she got the unaltered version, because we saw two versions at trial.
We did.
Somehow that test was placed back in Ethan's hands, which They really didn't get into how that occurred. I don't know at what point they handed that paper back to him to where he altered it. He scratched out a couple of the drawings, scratched out "help me." And apparently that's what was handed to them in the office. However, Jennifer Crumbly had already had the unaltered copy of it. And I'm just saying, Nina, if that is handed to me in a teacher's or in the principal's office, there is no circumstance under which I'm not taking my kid out of school immediately, having a massively deep and long conversation with my kid to try to find out what is going on. And most likely, I'm ending up bringing him to a hospital in order to get a 72-hour hold on him for the safety of others, but for the safety of my own child.
Yes.
I mean, that if that isn't a cry for help, I don't know what is.
You know,
and to me, that's what everything hung on. Like, I didn't care about her and the affair and the horses. What I cared about is she had the context from the March text messages, and then when she sees this, if a bell doesn't go off in her head, if red flags aren't flying in her head saying, oh my, you know, maybe all those messages, maybe he really does have something going on in terms of mental illness that I have to address. Like, this instant, I you're culpable in my world. You know, that's where I came down on it.
In Oakland County, which is where they live, there is an organization called Common Ground where you can take someone for immediate psychiatric intervention. And they were given the information about Common Ground, and they chose not to do anything.
I mean, that's what I'm saying. For me, personally, as a father of four and somebody who is, if I have any inclination to think that there's something going on with my kids, I'm on it. You know, like, it's just not one of those things that I'm going to sweep to the side and, you know, just chalk it up to something else as, you know, as nonsense, or they're playing around, or he's just being good. When you see your child saying, help me, when you see that document,
I would not have
cared what anybody in the school was saying to me, whether it be the counselor or the principals. It wouldn't have mattered what they said to me. I would have immediately embraced my kid. I would have taken my kid out of the office immediately and out of the school. Like, there would have been no question. Like, you're worried about work. You're worried about your DoorDash job or your work that you work from home. And in lieu of what's going on with your kid, I mean, to me, that the foreseeability of what was going to happen that day, not even getting into the fact that not only did the principal nor the counselor or the vice principal who brought the backpack to the office during the meeting, that they didn't open it, but that the parents didn't open it, that Jennifer and James didn't unzip that thing, knowing that they had bought the weapon 4 days prior, knowing that Ethan had been searching for ammo the day before, which tells you what his mindset is, where his head's at. To me, everything that was introduced at trial was impossible for me to get over, and that then switches the conversation to what this case is really about. I mean, this case is about gun control, gun reform, you know, and ultimately the jury understood, because I saw an interview today on Good Morning America with the foreperson of the jury.
Yeah,
they understood the significance of this trial and what it meant for this country moving forward. And that was not lost on them. Now, they're not supposed to take that into account. They're supposed to only deal with the facts, the law, and the evidence. But we are all human beings. You know, in my debates online and, you know, on social media over the past week have centered around, you know, you've got this line where people are like, oh, now every parent's going to be charged for every crime their child commits. And that's not true. What parents are going to be charged with is, if the state can demonstrate that you should have done something, that you knew and should have done something, then you're on the hook. You know, that it's a case-by-case analysis. It's not going to be, a bright red line where every charge or every parent's going to be charged for everything that their child does criminally. It's going to be a situation where law enforcement is going to be looking at what led up to the day in terms of their communications or lack of communications with their parents, and it's going to be evaluated whether or not this is foreseeable. And if it was foreseeable in the state's estimation and something should have been done by the parents and wasn't, then you're going to be on the hook.
Right. And maybe you should be.
And I absolutely think you should be. Look, we have to take driver's ed and go to a state facility and pass a driver's test to drive. You have to get a license to own a gun. You don't have to do any of that to become a parent, you know, and it's a scary proposition. And when we have the number of school shootings that have taken place over the past, since Columbine, really, it's stunning. You know, I mean, when you and I were young, we didn't have active shooter drills in school. It wasn't even a thought in our mind. The concept of us being in school, having to be worried if there's an active shooter that's going to happen on any given day, did not exist in our world, and it didn't exist for our parents either. And we just live in a vastly different world, and we have to adapt to it because it's our reality now. And to me, if this verdict stops one school shooting, then it's a massive victory for our country moving forward, because that means that parents are now on alert. We've been warned. We are on notice that it's time to start taking an interest in your children's lives. And look, Nina, we both have teenagers. We know that our teenagers don't necessarily want us in their business.
No.
But we have to make it our business to be in their business to a certain extent. That's our job. It's our duty as the parents. I mean, it's like, I don't know that there's a higher duty than I have to raise my kids. It certainly isn't working going to a job. As far as I'm concerned, my four kids are my priority over everything. And that includes making sure that they're okay at all times, whether it's physical illness. If my child breaks their arm, I'm bringing them to a doctor. Mental illness is the same type of thing. Just because you can't see it doesn't mean that it doesn't exist.
Right.
If you think that your child's mentally going through distress, you address it the same way you would with a physical injury. And it's just, it's not happening, you know, and it not in the way that it should be.
So I want to ask you a couple of questions specifically about the trial. I don't know how much of the trial you actually got to watch. I was glued, absolutely glued to YouTube for the last 10 days.
I was too.
Okay.
Yeah, me too.
So one of the questions that came up was why didn't the shooter testify? And I thought you would be a good person to clarify that for people.
So the easy answer is that Ethan has an appeal pending. Okay, even though he pled out, which is unusual in a plea deal for the defendant to then turn around and try to appeal it, he does have an appeal going, which is really going to revolve around whether or not counsel was ineffective in allowing him to plead out because they just didn't address his mental health issues. You know, they just didn't. You know, if you've had the opportunity and if you're listening and haven't had the opportunity, I highly recommend that you watch the Miller hearing that took place, which was in a Miller hearing, if you guys don't know out there, is basically the Supreme Court had stated in this Miller case that you can't just sentence a minor who's been charged as an adult to life without the possibility of parole without conducting a full hearing. They had that hearing. It went 4 days. It's incredibly disturbing. You know, I mean, they played so much evidence that they had with respect to where Ethan's mind was at the time leading up to the shootings. It's so sad. It's so sad. So watch the Miller hearing. It'll give you a lot of context. So he's got the appeal pending, and his attorneys, they had him plead the fifth. So, and in Michigan law and in most states, you cannot put a witness on the stand that you know is going to take the fifth, and take the fifth means that you know, that's a, it's your constitutional right against self-incrimination, meaning the state can't force you to go on the stand or anywhere once you take the fifth and testify against yourself. So once that was done, it was an interesting argument because the judge understood, you know, Shannon Smith, the defense attorney, was arguing, look, you know, I mean, we don't have the opportunity to confront our accuser, like that being Ethan, because they were using so much of the text messages, the Facebook Messenger, the posts, all the social media stuff was really the equivalent of Ethan testifying, right?
Right.
But typically you have the ability as the defense, and the Constitution requires that you're able to confront your accusers, which when he's taking the fifth, she can't do it, you know, and she kept looking for the judge to give her that language. I'm making a finding that you cannot call Ethan, and the judge wouldn't say it. She's like, I'm not saying that you can't call him. What I'm saying is that the law, as it's currently situated in Michigan, states that you cannot call a witness to the stand that you know is going to assert their Fifth Amendment right. And so she wouldn't say that. And she said, the only thing that I think that you could ask him is his name, because everything else will trigger his Fifth Amendment right. So it was, you know, so Shannon wanted that for appellate purposes.
Right.
You know, she wanted the judge to make that. She wanted the word a finding, and the judge wouldn't give it to her, you know, and that debate went on forever. It was one of the things that was irritating people about Shannon Smith. You know, and I was all over socials. I don't know what you watched it on. I mean, I could not handle watching it on Law and Crime because of the chat. You know, like I've got a YouTube community with some pretty bright people in there, and it's vastly different than what you're seeing on Law and Crime. It's like
I block the chat because I cannot. Oh, it's the drives.
It really is. It really is. So that's the short answer, is that she, you know, Ethan was not there to testify because he had asserted his Fifth Amendment right.
Okay. So you mentioned Shannon Smith, the defense attorney, mm-hmm. and I feel like Shannon, Ms. Smith, engendered big feelings in a lot of people. What mm-hmm. were your thoughts about the defense she presented?
I thought, like any defense attorney, the first thing that you have to realize is that you have to play the hand that you're dealt. And she was dealt a very, very tough hand.
She was.
You know, I mean, she really was. And beyond that, she was trying the case alone, which I kept trying to explain to people, you know, because she had somebody in there early and then he disappeared. And the ability to be able to try a case like that with that voluminous amount of discovery and evidence that's going to be introduced into evidence. And when you're trying to sit there and listen intently to a direct examination by the state to make your objections, which if you guys don't know out there, I mean, objections aren't to annoy people. They're not to annoy the trial viewer. They're not to annoy the state or the defense. What objections exist for is to you have to preserve the issue for appeal, because the only thing that the appellate courts look at in the event that there's a conviction is the record, the court record. So if Shannon Smith or the state doesn't object to certain things, that is considered to be waived. So when you're
right.
watching trials and you see sidebars and you see constant objections and you're getting annoyed with it because it's breaking up the flow of the cross, it's done out of necessity. It has to be done. So I thought, my personal opinion, and I'm probably biased because I'm married to a female attorney, who I see being demeaned in courts and underestimated all the time by her male counterparts, and Allison just doesn't care. She just plows forward.
Allison, who I've met, is a badass. She is awesome.
Yes, she is. And there, I saw a lot of Allison and Shannon Smith, and then I watched her there trying that case alone without somebody. Like, I'm just talking about the mechanics of, like, when you're trying to listen to a direct and write down questions and make your objections and make sure that everything that's being said is by the book. And at the same time, you're trying to dig through your computer or the paper files to see what exhibits they're introducing. It's a lot to handle, you know, which I think she addressed in the beginning of her closing. You know, she's like, look, I made mistakes. You know, when I'm taken by surprise, I get flustered. I just thought she was very human, but the one thing I know is she knew that case forward and backwards. And beyond that, she also understood the significance of the case beyond just her client. She understood what we're talking about today, that this is a case that's going to impact and change the way our country deals with parents moving forward with respect to the actions of their children, much in the same way 9/11 affected airports when we're trying to board a plane. It just changed that day, changed everything for us in terms of traveling in this country forever.
Right.
You know, and this is going to have that same effect on our country. And it's a pretty seismic shift. It really is. You know, so I thought that there was no way for her to handle that document that was handed to Jennifer Crumley. You know, that math test was like insurmountable to me. You know, it's like, because I was trying to think, how would I handle it? You know, and if it was her advice to Jennifer to make that statement that I'm sure when you heard it come out of her mouth, blew your hair back and you were like, oh my God, that cinched the case when Jennifer says, I wouldn't have done anything differently.
I was of two minds about that. So finish your thought, but.
Well, I was too, but in terms of me thinking about the effect on a jury who may not necessarily understand the significance of why she had her answer that way. And I assure you that was a question that was prepped. You know, that was a question and an answer that was prepped. And ultimately, if I think in Shannon's mind that she felt if she had her answer that question any other way, that it would have indicated that she knew.
Yes.
That she had knowledge and that it was foreseeable. You know, so I think I would have just skipped the question. You know what I mean? It was because ultimately, I think when the jury heard it, It stuck to him.
Yeah, I mean, there was a pause. And maybe there wasn't, but it felt like everything paused for half a second when she answered that way and then continued. Because if she says, yes, I would have done things differently, then she's guilty. And
right.
if she says, no, I wouldn't have done things differently, then she's a bad person.
Right, exactly.
There's no win to that question.
Right. There isn't. You know, and I would have probably decided to take the chance to see whether or not the state was going to ask it, because obviously the state could have asked it on cross. And I mean, it's an impossible question to answer, you know, in terms of what you're looking at, in terms of liability. And like you said, and the alternative to, you know, it's going to cause them to the jury to cast judgment. You know, I'm a terrible person. How can I sit here knowing what the end result of my actions or inactions were that day and sit here and say that I would do nothing different? You know, it's such a, like, she's not intending it for the way that it sounds, but that's the way it sounds.
Yeah, it landed badly.
Yeah, it did.
So in your expert opinion, do you think the defense should have called additional witnesses?
I thought about that. Like, I was trying to think about whether or not I was shocked that she didn't call anybody additional. I was trying to think of who she could have called that could have helped her. You know what I mean? It's like, and unless they had witnesses that could have bolstered how much she loved her kid.
Right.
You know, and how active she was in Ethan's life. And, you know, or somebody that, like, because you can't call somebody that you're afraid that they may say or may have knowledge, and on cross-examination they're asked by the state, did Jennifer ever talk to you about Ethan having potentially some kind of mental issues, you know, and that person being obligated and being under oath saying, yeah, you know, where the state, where the defense on direct was very careful not to get into that, you know, because they know what that answer would be. I mean, that salts it, you know what I mean? That salts the case for the state if they have another witness up there that, you know, that would testify, yeah, you know, Jennifer talked to me about Ethan's issues, you know, like just that statement alone, you know, her acknowledging that Ethan had issues and didn't do anything
about it. That opens up a whole can of worms.
A whole can of worms. So I don't know. What do you think? Do you think that was there anybody you would have liked to have seen that you think would have helped?
So my initial thought, and I was talking with a friend about this, and I said, I can't believe they couldn't find one person. She didn't have one girlfriend or neighborhood friend who would say, oh, yeah, she was a very involved mother. But then my friend pointed out correctly, I think, no one in Oxford is going to say anything nice about Jennifer, true or not.
Right.
If you have to live in that community, you're not going to defend Jennifer, you're not going to defend the shooter. You're not going to defend James.
It's a great point, and I'm sure absolutely true. You know, in that community, you know, like
it's a small community.
It is, and you're not going to be willing to do that because you're going to be a pariah. You've then lumped yourself in with the school shooter and the family of the school shooter, and who's going to sign up for that? No one.
Yeah.
No one's going to sign up for that. And, like, I don't even know how much that would have helped, you know? Like, at the end of the day, it's like, because that was my thing. And I kept debating with Allison, and Allison and I obviously had long discussions about it. And, you know, my thing was, like, as soon as they handed me that paper, that's a 30-second meeting at the school. I'm taking my kid out of school. First and foremost, to have a very, very long, deep discussion with my kid.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, we're all different as parents. I get it. You know, some parents, you know, I had friends growing up that they didn't, like, the family didn't deal with issues. They swept them under the rug. It just, they didn't like the confrontation. They didn't do it. You know, me being who I am and my wife being who she is, we deal with those things. I go to my kids. If I get any sense, with all my kids, I've done it. You know, if there's something wrong, I'm asking them, you know, and I'm saying, look, man, like there's no repercussion to what you're going to tell me. I just, you know, you have to know that all I'm doing here is telling you that I love you, and that if you need help, that I'm going to get you help, and there's no shame in it. You know what I mean? It's like you have to have those conversations with your kids. If you don't, I mean, we've seen what the result is. That's why this case is so important. It's so important because it's shining a light on exactly that issue. And like, we could spend hours talking about, you know, now that this verdict is in hand, and now do we shine a light on how difficult it can be to get the help for a vast majority of this country? You know, that it's not as simple as just saying, oh, you know, I want to put my kid in a facility. When you're dealing with the insurance problems, you're talking about the lack of beds in these facilities. You're talking about the care that they receive. I mean, it's such a systemic issue, deeply rooted problems. It's hard to know.
I want to reiterate that Oakland County, which is where Oxford is in Oakland County, has a place called Common Ground, and it is a mental health clearinghouse. If you are in crisis, that's where they take you. If you're having a mental health emergency in Oakland County, they take you to Common Ground. It's free. Anybody can go.
I mean, we need those in every town.
We need them everywhere. Now, I'm not saying that Common Ground is perfect. It's not. But it's
better than
nothing. We have something in place.
Exactly.
And they could have taken him, you know, Shannon Smith tried to make the point, well, you can't get a same-day appointment for mental health services. But he could have gone to the emergency room. He could have gone to Common Ground. He could have gone to his pediatrician. There were
absolutely
options.
You can. There is no circumstances under which if you think your child or anybody, a family member, is a threat to themselves or others, if you bring them to any emergency room, they will put them on a 72-hour hold.
Yes.
A psych hold, and they will evaluate them. I don't care. It's an emergency. You know, so like when she said that fell on deaf ears because I knew it was not true. And it's just inaccurate, you know, in terms of saying, like, calling up a facility and saying, hey, do you have a bed? And, like, maybe. But in a situation like that where you've got dire concerns, you know, about, again, you know, your loved one's safety or the safety of others, and you're going to go in for an involuntary hold, they're going to do it. Mm-hmm. You know, they're going to do it. They're not going to turn you away.
Many, many years ago, one of my, like, my first grown-up job after high school when I was a college student, I worked on a psychiatric unit as the admissions coordinator. And one of the things that I did as part of my job was assist families in completing involuntary commitment paperwork. So I actually have a good understanding of what it takes in Oakland County to get someone involuntarily committed to a psychiatric program. And in my opinion, based on the work that I did back in the day, Ethan definitely qualified to be involuntarily committed or voluntarily. He may have said, yes, please, I need to talk to someone. But he
very well, like, he might have, you know, like, you have to know, because when you look, if you watch that Miller hearing, he flat out says it.
Yeah.
He says that I fully intended on them stopping me at school. That note was the math test was his. It wasn't even a cry for help. It was like a scream at the top of his lungs that my mind is in a place where I'm about to do something unspeakable, and I'm begging my parents, anybody, to
pay
do
attention.
Something.
Yeah.
Yeah,
and his parents did not hug him. That,
oh, I know.
I'm a huggy mom. I hug my kids.
Me too.
And that,
I'm annoyingly huggy.
Yes. And that jumped out at me that she didn't, you know, and even if you're not a warm, huggy person, she didn't squeeze his hand. She didn't ruffle his hair. Like, and dad didn't either. So I'm not just laying that on mom. Neither parent, like, took him by the hand and looked him in the eye and went, dude, are you okay?
Right.
And if they had, this could have ended up very differently.
Very differently. Very, very differently. You know, and it's like the kid was failed by everyone around him, you know, because, like, I'm not giving the school a pass, and maybe, mm-hmm. I don't know, you know, in terms of the way that they handled it. I just know in our school district, if that note is found or handed to a teacher, the entire the school is getting shut down. We're getting emails, like, every parent in
right.
the district, and that's it. That's just how they handle it here in Illinois. It, like, all over the state. It's like, you know, I mean, you live where you used to live. You're a Michigan girl.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it's a militia state. You know, it's like it's a gun-loving state in that sense. You know, I mean, Illinois has very stringent, and I know that they finally passed a law that I think went into effect on the 4th or very, like, in February, and some gun reform law regarding, you know, the gun safes and things of that nature, and some very stiff penalties that frankly mirror the penalty of which Jennifer Crumbly is going to be sentenced for on April 9th in terms of 15 years. You have a gun in the house and you have a safe and you don't lock it and something catastrophic happens, you're looking at massive time on it, you know? So it's like they're addressing it. You know, and
yeah.
I mean, these are the kind of laws that have to be put in place. And it's a shame. It's a shame that you know, that we have to put laws into place, because people that love their guns and love the Second Amendment, and I know tons of gun owners, and gun safety is a huge thing for them. They take it very seriously, but not everybody does, you know,
yeah.
and that's where we run into the issues. You know, so I think, like, very stringent laws for those who may be a little more lackadaisical with respect to their, you know, their personal gun safety habits, that's going to change. It's got to change. You know, we can't make these weapons accessible to children. You know, we need those laws in place that are really making it difficult and not impossible for people that are clearly in mental distress to be able to access weapons, because, I mean, the damage is unbelievable. I mean, you can't even, like, I can't even, as a father, I can't even begin to think of what my life would be like if I was if that was one of my kids, if that happened.
Oh,
like, it changes the fabric of everything. Like, your entire life is changed in the worst way possible, moving forward forever, you know?
Yes.
And it's everyone that had connection and love to that, you know, for that kid and the friends and family and teachers and community. It's like the impact on these things is so massive. It's like something has to be done.
Yes.
Something has to be done. So I really thought it was going to come back hung. I really thought.
A lot of people did.
I really thought that there was going to be a juror or two on there that was thinking about the chilling effect that the case would have on families, even though they're not supposed to take that into consideration. You know, again, it's the facts, the evidence, and the law. That's the only thing you consider. You cannot consider what effect this case will have on America moving forward. You're not allowed
right.
to do that. However, again, we're human. So I just thought that there'd be one or two parents on there that's like, I'm not willing to sign up for that, because I saw it. You know, I kept doing polls on my Twitter. I'm like, where are you at? Like, what, you know, like, where do you think this is going to be? And when I did, I was doing a YouTube live, and when I was streaming the cross-examination of Jennifer Crumbly, and I asked the question, I'm like, guilty or innocent, hung is not a, you know, you can't not vote. You have to vote one way or other. So it's not guilty or guilty. And by the time, so initially it was about 60-40 guilty. By the time after Shannon Smith's closing, which, you know, people had differing opinions on whether or not it was effective, I thought it was effective in certain ways. I thought it was shocking that the state didn't object to her
yes.
in terms of personalizing it, because you're not allowed to do it. It's called, like, every time I've ever done it during a closing, within three words of me saying I or me, like, the state's objecting, because it's improper vouching or bolstering of a witness, because you're basically putting yourselves in the shoes of the defendant saying, oh, well, if this was me, I would have done the same thing, which is improper, you know? So I was surprised. But the state must have been like, run with it, lady, you know. but when, like, after that second, you know, after her closing and before the state's, I did another poll, and it had shifted. It had shifted. I think it was 52-48, not guilty, which was shocking to me. And I probably had about 500 people in the live, so it wasn't like 10 people. You know what I mean?
It was a good sample.
It was a good sample, and, you know, I'm like, man, that's it, you know, because I had both sides of it in the chat. And so it was a very interesting kind of sociological type experience for me to kind of see where people's minds are at, because it really is one of those issues that kind of divides along the lines, you know, whether it be conservative or liberal or pro-gun or anti-gun. You know, there's a lot of lines that are drawn with that thing. You know, less government, more government. Do we want the government telling us how we should parent? You know, all those things that are going on in your mind when you think about this. It was shocking to me to see that it had flipped. But what I felt is, I'm like, that's a microcosm. That is the jury. These folks in the chat are the jury. And I just thought that there'd be one. I never thought it was going to go NG, but I thought that it would be hung. So when it came back as guilty, I was like, wow, I was stunned. But I had told everybody, I'm like, for me, like, where I'm at with this is it's guilty. And it's because of that math quiz. Everything, like, that test, that cry for help right there was where she failed her child
yes.
the most. And it created the foreseeability that day.
The
you
way
know,
she
it,
responded to the math test, for me, everything else aside, the way she responded to that math test
was
what
right?
pushed me. Yeah, I mean, I don't care who she was screwing. I don't care
exactly.
how many horses she had. I don't care about what she was doing or not doing at work. What got me was if one of my students, I used to be a teacher, if one of my students did that, I would be wrapping them in a blanket and being like, honey, what is wrong?
Right.
You know, not
exactly.
even my own kid. If one, and
right.
she just didn't, they just seemed bothered by him. And that to me was what sealed the deal. And
yep,
also the jury taking, people felt the jury took a long time, although it was only like a day and a half. I think they were being methodical, which is what you want your jury to be. I think, like
100%.
You said, they were taking it seriously and doing their own due diligence.
100%. I would have been grossly disappointed if they'd come back in 3 hours, because that is just not enough time for any kind of substantial deliberation to take place. And there were a myriad of issues that had to be discussed, not just because if we were flies on the wall back there in that jury deliberation room, even though I keep saying that they shouldn't be talking about, because it's not supposed to factor into their decision about the ramifications of this verdict moving forward, I guarantee you they were.
Yeah, they want to get it right.
They want to get it right. They want to get it right. And it's that thing where, you know, I was getting people to turn. Like, I was playing like I was the foreperson in my chat, and, you know, I was kind of making my argument. And I was like, look, at the end of the day, no matter what the case may be, she had knowledge at that point. It was foreseeable, you know, but, like, by the law, like, you have to vote guilty. And then you have to put aside, you know, I was addressing that. You have to put aside the fact that, you know, so now you know by the law that they've proven it beyond a reasonable doubt. Like that test, and like you said, her response to it, like she was like, I can't remember her exact words, but she was like, I was kind of disturbed by it. Like, you know what I mean? It was like whatever she said in reference to her seeing that paper was not the appropriate response. Like,
agreed.
Anybody, you know what I mean? It was like, I was like, oh, my God. It's like those things, like there were three things that she said to me that were like just evident that she, it's like you said, like you got the sense that like everything that he did that interfered with what she was doing was super irritating to her, you know, and that she wasn't handling it as, oh my God, like I have to see what's going on with my kid, but rather, oh my God, like, you serious with this kid?
Yeah.
Like, really? I it was the right, in my estimation, and I know there's people that disagree with me, but in my estimation, it was 100% the right verdict, and it had to go down. And like I said, if one school shooting is avoided because of this verdict, then it's a massive win. If they slow down, then it's an enormous win. It's for our country, for our children.
Yes.
For everybody, you know? I mean, to me, it's such an important case. And it just wasn't like, I was really kind of screaming from the rooftops. I'm like, people need to be waking up.
Yeah.
This is a huge case. It's a case of first impression. It's the first time they've ever done this anywhere in this country. Lock up your guns. Pay attention to your kids.
Yep.
Yeah.
So one more question before we wrap up. We were told that sentencing in this case will take place April 9th. Now, why do we have to wait until April 9th for sentencing? And do you have any predictions about the sentence?
So, yeah, typically when you have sentencing in a case like this, where there's a range, you know, and go up to 15 years per victim, per count, and they're going to do probation is going to go, and they're going to do a pre-sentencing investigation. They're going to dig in. They're going to look at everything. They're going to talk to people. They're going to talk to Jennifer. They're going to talk to, at that point, they'll probably try to talk to friends. You know, they try to do a very thorough investigation to give the judge some guidance. You know,
now, who is doing this investigation?
Typically, it's probation. Like,
okay.
The probation department, you know, they have a department in the court system that is going to typically handle those pre-sentence investigations. And it does, it's helpful for the judge to give them more context outside of the confines of what was admitted in court. You know, there'll be things that are talked about that were not discussed in court because they weren't admissible. So that's the primary reason that they put it out. I mean, many times in cases you'll see sentencing happen the same day. You know, this isn't one of those cases. The judge realized that this is a case where the sentence is going to be a big deal. Like, I mean, the eyes on the world are going to be on that sentencing hearing, too, on April 9th. I'll tell you that. My prediction, I don't think they're going to hammer her in the way that people think that they should some. I think that she's going to do some serious time. My prediction is she'll probably get somewhere in between 15 and 20 years as opposed to 60. I mean, 60, if the judge were to rule, and let me preface it. I don't know in Michigan if the law allows for these sentences or you know, each charge to run consecutively, meaning one after another. So she does 15, she does 15, she does 15, she does 15, equaling the 60, or if they can run concurrent.
I think they can run concurrent. I think it can go either way.
Okay, so, yeah, if that's the case, then, you know, I really feel like it's going to land in somewhere in the 15 to 20-year range total, which is substantial punishment for her not being the actor, you know, and it's life-altering. You know, her life's going to be over.
Yeah.
I mean, that's a long sentence. What do you think? What's your guess on it?
I think she's going to get hit with the max, but it'll be 15, you know, she'll get 15 years on all four counts to run concurrently with parole after 8. Eligibility for parole after 8.
That sounds,
is my guess.
That sounds plausible. Definitely sounds plausible. You know, yeah, I wouldn't, that wouldn't shock me if that was a sentence. It's like you try to look at the judge's demeanor and it was so snarky between Smith and the male counterpart on the state side.
Yeah,
yeah.
They were, counsel should not be addressing me. Oh my.
Right. Yeah, it was going on, you know, and I thought the judge, I liked her demeanor. A lot of people felt like she was too low key. I thought she was the right temperature for this trial.
I agree with you.
And I think that she'll be real thoughtful. And look, the way that it goes with sentencing, you can guarantee that she will be speaking at length with all of her colleagues with regards to, you know, how this thing should go. You know, I mean, there's going to be a lot of thought in it.
I think she's another one who understands the gravity of this situation.
Agreed.
The judge.
Agreed.
So
yeah.
I actually have one more question for you. I lied. I have one more. If you were James Crumbly's attorney, would you be angling for a plea right now?
Man, like they had, so a lot of people were asking, and just so people understand, in terms of the order in which they tried the cases, they tried Jennifer's first because they felt that they had the stronger case against her, especially because what became evident throughout the course of the trial is that she had a lot more communication with Ethan.
Yes.
So in terms of proving, you know, knowledge and foreseeability, I think that the state believed that it was a stronger case in terms of the evidence that they had against her. That being said, in light of the fact that even though they can't necessarily talk about the verdict of this case in his case, the world knows.
Right.
You know, so like that's not going to be something, even if the judge gives like a curing instruction, they can't take into consideration that his wife was convicted on this, that can't factor in. It doesn't matter because of the thing that I keep saying. It's like it's in there subconsciously. So, yeah, I would 100% be trying to, like, I'm going to wait, see what the sentence is, and at that point I'm going to, you know, try to just plead it out, you know.
Well, His trial is scheduled for March, and her sentencing is scheduled for April.
Yeah, that's such a like, I'd be trying to continue it until after sentencing to see, like, under the premise of, like, we're trying to work out a plea deal.
Yeah.
And we need some guidance in terms of what, you know, what we think is, you know, an appropriate plea on this thing. So I don't know. The judge may deny it, but I would certainly try it, you know, because to kind of do a, you know, because the other thing you could do is a blind plea. And a blind plea is where you're rejecting the state's offer, because the state will come in with what their recommendation is, you know, during that sentencing hearing. And I'm sure they're going to seek the max not to run concurrent.
Yes.
You know, so they'll go to the extreme. And if they're making that same offer to James, you know, he's going to reject that, I would assume, you know, especially if they're not going to be able to get it continued before sentencing, where it's still unknown what her sentence is going to be. And that blind plea is where you reject the state's offer and you allow the judge to do the sentencing, which could be the move here. You know, like I would probably be suggesting to James that we do a blind plea or a cold plea. They call it one or the other, wherein it's the judge that's just doing, you know, is going to come up with the sentence without accepting a plea agreement from the state. You're saying, all right, well, we don't want to go to trial, and we're not willing to accept the state's plea agreement.
Let the judge
so
do it.
Just let the judge do it, you know, and I mean, it would certainly tell us where the judge's head's at as far as Jennifer as well, if that happens. But if I'm assuming that the state's going to go full bore at Jennifer and that would be the same exact offer for James, then that's probably the move.
It'll be interesting to see how it plays out.
It will, definitely.
And if James goes on trial, I'm watching.
Oh, 100%.
Yeah, I was.
Because it'll be a very different trial.
It will.
You know, because, you know, he was guilty of other things, you know, like the access to the gun. I mean, Jennifer, they were throwing him under the bus. You know, that's his deal. He's the guy who's supposed to be locking the gun up. You know, that's his thing. He's the one who took him to buy the gun, not me. I didn't even know what was happening. You know what I mean? So it's like it'll be a very different trial. It won't be like a repeat, that's for sure.
As a mother, it concerns me that Jennifer might be sentenced or treated more harshly because she's the mom rather than James as the dad, who should be considered equally culpable.
100%. I agree. Like, absolutely. You know, like, this is not the 30s, 40s, 50s anymore where, you know, like, it's all hands on deck with your kids.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this isn't Mad Men. I don't change diapers. That's my wife's duty. You know, like, we don't live in that world anymore,
right.
Thank God. You know,
right.
So, yeah, that is a concern. I take solace in the fact that we have a female judge, though. So,
that helps. Yeah, that helps.
It does. It really does. And, you know, I mean, it could go the other way, where if the judge is like, you're the one who put the gun in his hands because you went and bought it for him.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean,
and then didn't lock it up
and didn't lock it up and didn't secure it. You know, it's because like he had knowledge. I mean, they're certainly going to introduce, you know, the conversations between Jennifer and James, you know, and there were a lot of conversations about, you know, between them. And he was super dismissive. Just put your head down, do the work. Do good in school and you'll get your stuff back. You know, it's like he's that guy.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? He's not the guy who's sitting having heart-to-hearts with his kids.
Although, I did notice that when they got to see the shooter at the jail, at the police substation, Jennifer said, "Why?" And James said, "I love you, I love you, I love you, I love you."
Yeah.
And that jumped out to me. The very different reactions that they had to their child.
Yeah. I mean, it's like after the fact, you
yeah,
know,
a little late,
like, a little late, but I mean, if we can see evidence that he was doing that prior to, which I've seen no evidence of that taking place.
Mm-mm.
I mean, the kid just seemed like he was out on an island, you know, like kind of that verbal manifesto that he recorded that,
yes,
again,
I listened
y'all
to
haven't
that.
Listened to the mirror. Yeah, I mean, it's heartbreaking. It's heartbreaking, you know, and the kid was clearly bright. You know, he had a lot of thoughts on a lot of different things, you know what I mean? And
yeah.
He was like, he was failed by everybody, you know, and he's still sitting in there in prison, never having been psychologically evaluated. That's like, that's insane to me. Like,
yeah, that he's not getting the
help. I mean, he's in prison now. You know, you've got this kid who's like just teeming with mental illness, just running rampant through his mind without getting any treatment. You know, it's like, but that is a microcosm of our country and, you know, how we deal with mental illness in this country. And I've been doing it for 20 years in the criminal justice system, trying to get prosecutors to understand that mental illness is like 90% of most criminal cases are due, in fact, to some kind of mental illness going on with the defendant. You know,
yeah.
It's either that or addiction. You know, it's always one of those two things.
And sometimes it's both.
Typically it is both because they go hand in hand.
Yeah. Well, Bob, thank you. Thank you for answering all my questions and sharing your wisdom. I really appreciate the opportunity to talk with you about this. I always like talking to you.
Yeah, ditto. Yeah, I miss you. I'll see you soon.
Yes.
And it's my pleasure, of course.
Absolutely.
You know, I'm always here for you.
Thank you.
Listeners, I always enjoy hearing Bob's take on these cases, and I'm grateful that he made time to talk with us today. You can find Bob's podcast, Defense Diaries, on your favorite podcatcher, and you can learn more about Bob's work by visiting defensediaries.com. We will be back with a new episode on February 15th. As always, I appreciate you listening, and please, be safe.